Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Classes of Mail. My name is Alan Gygax, and we are going to pick up reading more of the ELM. So let's get right to it. We start with 435 severance pay. I guess in case you get released from the post office, I can't imagine this comes up very often, but it's interesting to know the provisions, and we are erring on the side of being thorough. So that's where we're going to start today, 435 severance pay. 435.1, eligibility and qualifying job offer. 435.11, eligibility. A career postal service employee is eligible for severance pay if the following applies. A, the employee is involuntarily separated. So that must be the part that makes this so rare is usually if we're involuntarily separated, it's because we get fired. And that doesn't happen very often. And so going beyond that, getting involuntarily separated from not being fired has got to be, as they say, as rare as hen's teeth. But we're going to continue. B, immediately before the separation, the Postal Service, another federal agency, or both continuously employed the employee for at least 12 consecutive months without a break in service of 3 or more consecutive days. A career Postal Service employee is not eligible for severance pay in the following circumstances. A, the employee is entitled to an immediate retirement annuity from a federal civilian retirement system or from the uniformed services. Note, if the employee becomes eligible for a retirement annuity after being involuntarily separated, his or her eligibility for severance pay ends on the date he or she became eligible for the annuity, and the employee will not receive any additional severance pay after that date. The employee does not reimburse the Postal Service for any severance pay received before that date. B. Within the 60-day period before the employee's separation, the employee receives and declines to accept a written qualifying job offer as defined in 435.12. Oh, that makes me think that there may be severance due to, like, injury, where you can no longer work and so your employment is severed. That may be one of the circumstances. C. The employee is administratively separated because, following entry into military service, he or she has become ineligible for reemployment under USERRA. D. The employee is separated for cause on charges of misconduct, delinquency, or inefficiency. Again, remember, these are the reasons that you wouldn't qualify for severance pay. E. At the time of separation, the employee is receiving compensation as a beneficiary of the Federal Employees Compensation Act, except when the employee is receiving this compensation concurrently with Postal Service pay or because of someone else's death. 435.2, computing severance fund. 435.21, limitation. In no case can the severance pay fund exceed 52 weeks basic compensation. 435.22, creditable service. Creditable service means all service as a paid federal civilian or postal employee and all military service that interrupts a period of paid federal civilian or postal service, excluding any period of federal or postal service for which severance pay has been previously paid. 435.23, paid allowance. The employee is credited with 1 week's basic compensation, in effect at the time of separation, for each year of creditable service up to 10 years. The employee is credited with 2 weeks basic compensation for each year of creditable service in excess of 10 years. Each three-month period of service that exceeds one or more full years of service is computed as 25% of a full year. A. Employee in non-pay status. In this case, the basic compensation is the basic compensation the employee would have received had he or she been in a pay status at the time of separation. B. Part-time regular employee. In this case, determine the basic weekly compensation by multiplying the number of hours in the employee's regular schedule by the employee's hourly rate of compensation. C, part-time flexible. D, I must have parsed that wrong. Anyway, with a part-time flexible, in this case, divide by 52 the total number of hours, excluding overtime hours, but including paid leave hours, that the employee had to his or her credit during the previous 52 weeks to find the average hours worked per week, and then multiply the average hours worked per week by the employee's hourly rate of compensation to determine the basic weekly compensation. 435.24, allowance to age over 40. The employee's basic allowance is increased by 10% for each full year and by 2.5% for each full 3 months in excess of a full year that the employee's age exceeds 40 years at the time of separation. For example, if the employee's age at the time of separation is 42 years and 7 months, the basic allowance computed in 435.23 above is increased by 25%, 10% for each of the 2 years in excess of 40, and 2.5% for each of the full 2 3-month periods in excess of the two full years. So that's nice. If they cut you loose when you're old, then you get more severance. So that's something. Next, 436, back pay. Now, here's something that is a little bit more relevant to us. 436.1, corrective entitlement. An employee or former employee is entitled to receive back pay for the period during which an unjustified or unwarranted personnel action was in effect that terminated or reduced the basic compensation, allowances, differentials, and employment benefits that the employee normally would have earned during that period. For purposes of entitlement to employment benefits, the employee is considered as having rendered service for the period during which the unjustified or unwarranted personnel action was in effect. So when you successfully file a grievance and they say, oh, we shouldn't have suspended you for that time, then this is the provision that lets you get that back pay. 436.2, limitations. Limitations to corrective entitlement are as follows. A, any amount that the employee earned in new employment or in an enlarged part-time employment to replace Postal Service employment must be determined and offset against the amount of the reimbursement to which he or she would be entitled. So you go out, you get another job because you're waiting for the post office to bring you back, and you can't go without pay for that long. So if you earn money at another job, your back pay is going to be reduced by that amount. B, back pay is allowed unless otherwise specified in the appropriate award or decision, provided the employee has made reasonable efforts to obtain other employment as follows. 1. Job applicants not hired by the Postal Service must immediately make reasonable efforts to obtain other employment. 2. Separated employees or employees on indefinite suspension are allowed 45 days before they must make reasonable efforts to obtain other employment. Exception. Postal Service employees eligible for veterans preference are not required to make reasonable efforts to obtain other employment while pursuing an administrative appeal with the Merit Systems Protection Board. C. No back pay is allowed for any period during which the person was not ready, willing, and able to perform the duties of the Postal Service position. D. Leave that is credited as a result of the corrective action may not exceed the maximum amount of leave to which the employee was eligible. E. The employee is not entitled to increases in pay resulting from deferment of step increases due to unsatisfactory service or salary increases resulting from ranking action. And F, any claim made by a Postal Service employee or his or her authorized agent or attorney for back pay must be submitted to the appropriate office within 6 full years after the date the claim first accrued. 436.3, corrective action. The installation head or other appropriate authority determining that a previous decision was unjustified or unwarranted initiates and directs the corrective action to be taken to ensure appropriate earnings to the employee for the affected period. 436.4, documents in support of a claim. 436.41, statement by local official. The following statement must be provided on PS Form 8039, back pay decision/settlement worksheet. A. The local official must provide a tabulation of the number and type of pay hours with which the employee should have been credited during the back pay period, including any annual or holiday leave taken, as follows. So just to clarify here, when you get that back pay award, the union doesn't figure out how much you're owed. They submit the settlement to management, and then management figures out how much you're owed. That burden lies with them. 1. Overtime hours and or night differential, as applicable, are determined by averaging the number of hours that other employees of the office with the same employment status were assigned during the back pay period. 2. If the claim is for a part-time flexible employee, a tabulation must be provided that shows the number and type of pay hours the employee experienced for a full 13 pay periods prior to the separation or suspension. If the back pay is less than one full pay period, only a 6 pay period tabulation is required. B. The local official must provide a statement indicating whether the employee is entitled to any of the following during the back pay period. 1. Premium pay. And I skipped 2. I don't even remember what that was, but it was not relevant. 3. Change in pay rate or salary schedule. 4. Step increase and date effective. 5. change in leave category and date effective. C, other changes in pay of a general application. And 7, any other employment-related benefits. C, the local official must provide a statement indicating that had the employee not been suspended or removed, he or she would have worked the hours as reported. D, the local official must provide a statement showing that monies earned by the employee for other employment during the period covered by the corrected action must be deducted, provided the earnings were from work that replaced the lost postal employment. E, the local official will use the employee's responses to the questions in PS Form 8038, Employee Statement to Recover Back Pay, as a reference when completing PS Form 8039. Any discrepancies between the two back pay forms should be resolved prior to submissions of the forms for processing. So I'm fortunate that I have never been in this situation, but apparently there's this form you have to fill out, the 8038, that you'll state, you know, answer whatever questions. I presume there's questions in there about like, what other job did you have? Well, how much money do you make? Stuff like that. And then they fill out the 8039, which actually gets you your back pay. F, the local official must ensure that PS Form 8039 is completed in full and all necessary signatures, including the employees, are obtained prior to submission of the documents for processing. 436.42, statements by employee. The following must be provided by the employee on PS Form 8038. Ah, here's the questions that you have to answer. Employee statement to recover back pay. A, where the original action resulted in separation or suspension, the employee must furnish the following. 1, the employee must provide a statement as to whether he or she earned any income during the back pay period. If the employee received any outside earnings, the employee must provide information on whether the earnings were from any of the following. A, a part-time job held at the time of removal. B, in a new job. Or C, in an enlarged part-time job obtained to replace Postal Service employment. In any of these cases, the employee must provide a statement from the employer showing the record of hours worked and gross earnings during the back pay period. 2, if the employee was already working in a part-time job at the time of removal or suspension, the employer should include the employee's record of employment for the 6-month period prior to the removal or suspension. 3, if outside earnings were from self-employment, the employee must provide an affidavit stating the amount earned during the back pay period. If such employment existed before the back pay period, the earnings must also be stated for 13 pay periods prior to the back pay period. So, I'm curious about this. If I had my postal job and then I had a side gig, like I do have a side gig where I take people hiking for money on Airbnb experiences. It's a side thing on Airbnb where you can book experiences where you go out with a local person and I take people hiking. So that's something that I do in addition to my postal employment. So if I was already making postal money plus my Airbnb money, now I lose my postal job. Does this mean that they're going to take my Airbnb money away from my back pay? That it doesn't feel right to me. All right. B, the employee must provide a statement as to whether he or she received any unemployment compensation, and if so, state the amount received and the state that made the payments. C, the employee must provide a statement that he or she was ready and able to perform his or her job during the back pay period. If not, the employee must state inclusive dates, not ready and able, and the cause of the incapacity or unavailability. The employee may request payment of sick or annual leave as appropriate to his or her credit for the period of incapacity or unavailability during the back pay period. D, where the original action resulted in separation or indefinite suspension, and the employee obtained no outside employment for all or any part of the back pay period, the employee must furnish the following. 1, if the back pay period is 45 days or less, the employee is not required to certify or to provide documentation in support of efforts to secure other employment during this period. 2, if the back pay period is more than 45 days and does not exceed 6 months, the employee must provide a statement certifying the reasons why he or she did not obtain outside employment for all parts of the back pay period that exceed the first 45 days. And 3, if the back pay period is more than 6 months, the employee must provide documentation in support of efforts to secure other employment for all parts of the back pay period that exceed the first 45 days. E, on health benefit coverage, the employee should state whether he or she desires to, 1, enroll in any plan, the same as a new employee, or 2, have the prior enrollment reinstated, retroactive to the date it was terminated. F, Where the original action resulted in a denial of employment with the Postal Service, the individual must provide documentation in support of his or her efforts to secure other employment for all parts of the back pay period. The individual must also provide a statement of earnings during the back pay period. G. The employee must complete in full and sign both PS Form 8038 and PS Form 8039, indicating his or her agreement or disagreement with the local official's completion of the form. If the employee does not agree, the basis for the disagreement should be explained. All right, 436.5 is a big section that goes over life insurance. If you're interested, we do get life insurance provided to us by the Postal Service, and then you can also purchase additional life insurance if you want. All of that is covered in 436.5. 436.7, interest on back pay. 436.71, purpose. This section establishes procedures for paying interest that the Postal Service is obligated to pay pursuant to the law, court order, arbitration, or federal agency decision, national labor agreement, or Postal Service settlement agreement. This section does not create any Postal Service obligation to pay interest on back pay claims. So on this note, we are in contract negotiations still. We're like a year beyond when our last contract expired. And the presumption is that when we get the new contract, that we will get back pay for what our raises would have been, you know, retroactive back to when the new contract should have started. But I don't think we're going to get any interest on that. And every day that we go without a contract, the Postal Service essentially holds that money that they should have been paying us. And we could be talking, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of million dollars. I don't know how much, but a tremendous amount of money. And they get to just keep that money. And then when they finally have to pay us, they keep all the interest on that money that, you know, we could have been earning. And that's bogus. That's, you know, that's a disincentive for the post office to complete these contract negotiations in a timely manner, because the longer they stretch it out, the bigger that pool of money is. Yeah, it's a big pool of money that they have to pay us, but there's also a big pool of money that they just get to keep on account of not having to pay us. And that sucks. 436.72, availability of interest. Interest is paid on back pay only under the following circumstances. A, decisions. Awards resulting from legally binding determinations by courts of law, administrative agencies, or the grievance and arbitration process. They are handled as follows. 1. Administrative agency decisions. Interest is paid automatically by accounting services for decisions issued by the following agencies: Merit Systems Protection Board, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and National Labor Relations Board. 2. Court decisions. Interest is not paid unless specifically awarded in the decision. 3. Arbitration decisions. Interest is paid automatically for arbitration decisions that award back pay for a disciplinary suspension or removal for employees represented by the National Association of Letter Carriers and the APWU for cases heard after June 12, 1991. Note, for arbitration decisions that are unrelated to a disciplinary suspension or removal, interest is not paid unless it is specifically required by the award. B. Settlements. Awards resulting from agreements between a representative of the Postal Service and an authorized employee representative that are reached through negotiation. Interest is not paid unless it is specifically required by the settlement agreement. 437. Waiver for claims of erroneous payment of pay. So this is if, rather than go through the whole chapter or the whole section, basically it says that if the post office accidentally pays you too much, they're going to ask for that money back, which is reasonable, and this section covers that process. But the most important thing is that it says you can ask to keep the money, and there are certain circumstances where you may be allowed to just keep it. So you can also make claims against the post office if they accidentally deduct too much pay, and you know they will pay you the amount that they over-deducted. So that's... if you have to pay back, you know, they'll give you like a demand letter that says, hey, we've been paying you an extra dollar an hour for the last 3 months, and now you owe us $842 or whatever it is. Next, 438, pay during travel or training. 438.1, pay during travel. 438.11, definitions. Definitions relevant to pay during travel or training include the following. A. Travel time. Time spent by an employee moving from one location to another during which no productive work is performed and excluding the normal mealtime if it occurs during the period of travel. B. Local commuting area. The suburban area immediately surrounding the employee's official duty station and within a radius of 50 miles. So if you are traveling 50 miles, wait a minute. Oh, then that's considered the local commuting area. Okay. Yeah, because that comes up in some other sections as well. 438.121, regular commuting. Commuting time before or after the regular workday between an employee's home and official duty station or any other location within the local commuting area is a normal incident of employment and is not compensable. It is not compensable regardless of whether the employee works at the same location all day or commutes home after the workday from a location different from the one where the workday started. 438.122, commuting to a different work site. Commuting time to and from work is not compensable when an employee is called back to work after the completion of the regular workday. However, such commuting time is compensable if the employee is called back to work at a location other than his or her regular work site. So this does not exclude CCAs. So it may be that you come in for a four-hour shift, they send you home, and then they say, oh, the Sunrise Station needs you, you know, can you go back to work? Yeah, you can, but now from the time you leave your house, you should be getting paid. So that's something to look into if you wind up, you know, going home and then getting called back to another station. 438.132, travel from job site to job site. This is definitely something that CCAs have to do from time to time. The following up, and there are probably some regular carriers who have to do that too because of whatever type of job they have. The following applies to travel from job site to job site. A, rule. Time spent at any time during a service day by an eligible employee and travel from one job site to another without a break in duty status within a local commuting area is compensable. So that makes sense. You clock in, you start your tour, and then they say, oh, we need you to go over to the Sunrise Station. You're going to be paid for the time that you go from the one station to the other. B, eligibility. This type of travel time is compensable for all employees during their established hours of service on a scheduled workday. So again, you clock in, they tell you to go somewhere else, you're going to get paid during that travel. 438.2, pay during training. 438.21, general. 29 CFR 785.27 states, that's a law that it's citing here. Attendance at lectures, meetings, training programs, and similar activities need not be counted as working time if the following four criteria are met. So you have to meet all four of these. One, attendance is outside the employee's regular working hours. Two, attendance is, in fact, voluntary. Three, the course, lecture, or meeting is not directly related to the employee's job. And four, the employee does not perform any productive work during such attendance. If any one of the four criteria is not met, the time must be counted as working time. Note, if the postal training imparts knowledge and skills uniquely beneficial to the postal service, it is to be considered as time worked whether the training is directly related to the employee's job or not. So this is something that you could make an argument that I got some sort of training and it benefits the post office, and so I should get paid for that time. I don't know how hard that argument would be to make. Like, if they didn't tell you to go get this training, then are they going to pay you for it? I don't know. 438.222, training during established hours of service. All employees are eligible for compensation for training for any training time which occurs during their established hours of service on a scheduled workday. For the purposes of the preceding sentence, any leave time is not considered established hours of service on a scheduled workday. However, when a senior qualified employee, pursuant to a voluntary bid, engages in scheme study, training, testing, and qualifying, that employee may elect to use annual leave for such purpose and for directly related travel that would be compensable under 438.132, provided that the employee has a sufficient annual leave balance. The study, training, testing, and qualifying time must be recorded on PS Form 2432, Individual Training Progress Report. Where the senior bidder passes the appropriate examination and accepts the position, the annual leave, including compensable travel, will be converted to hours worked. The employee's annual leave balance will be recredited a like number of hours, and FLSA premium pay may be due for any hours worked over 40 in any such work week. Next, we have a big section on what are called salary offsets, which is how the Postal Service collects debt. One note of note in this section is that it says if you have to pay a debt because of a court order, the Postal Service can deduct up to 25% of your salary. 464.5, garnishments. Administrative salary offsets based on Section 5 of the Debt Collection Act of 1982 and court judgment salary offsets based on Section 124 of Public Law 97.276 are not, as a matter of law, considered garnishments. For purposes of determining an employee's disposable earnings under the Federal Consumer Credit Protection Act, these withholdings are considered to be amounts required by law to be deducted. Accordingly, they should be deducted before the applicable garnishment ceilings are imposed and before deductions for garnishments are made. So if you have garnishments, those are added after the post office collects its money, the stuff that it's supposed to take out. The good news is that it leaves the garnishment, the 25%, on a smaller pool of salary. So if you're in these circumstances, I guess that's some cold comfort, but it's something. Also of note is that you can grieve letters of demand from the post office. It is available to run this through the grievance arbitration process. The post office sends you this letter of demand. If you don't think you owe it, then you can file a grievance on it. And the post office will hold in abeyance its attempt to collect the debt until the grievance is settled. All right, now we get to Section 490, Recognition and Awards. This subchapter establishes the conditions and procedures for the recognition of all postal service employees except for the following. And then there's a list here of a bunch of employees of the Postal Service who aren't you. So you are eligible for recognition and awards. And when's the last time that happened? I know I brought this up on a previous episode when this was first touched on earlier in the 400s. And I got an email from somebody who said, oh yeah, that happened in Seattle, like back in the 90s is the last time that person remembered anybody getting like a quality step increase or any kind of like cash awards. But this is still in the ELM. And to me, it's important that our bosses recognize that there are carrots available to them. They don't have to just only use sticks to get us to perform the way they want. They can actually do acts of kindness to their employees. I know it seems unthinkable, but let's learn about it. Our supervisors are apparently not going to bother learning about this, so we'll have to learn about it for them. 491.12, policy. The recognition and awards program is intended to recognize employees who have achieved outstanding performance, have superior competence, or have performed some other significant accomplishment. The program is not intended to provide incentives to employees to meet predetermined goals. The program has been broadly designed to ensure that the recognition and award needs of all organizations and functional areas are met. The awards offered range from a letter of appreciation to $12,500 in cash. Recognition falls into seven broad categories. A. Certificate of Appreciation. B. Service awards for which non-cash recognition items such as service award pins, retirement recognition, and posthumous service certificates are awarded. So both of these A and B are things that don't really cost the post office anything, and yet they still don't do them. C. Informal awards limited to non-cash tangible items valued at less than $100. D. Formal awards including cash, cash equivalents, gift certificates, and non-cash tangible items. Now we're talking. E, special awards, including but not limited to the Vice President Award, the Postmaster General Award, and the Benjamin Franklin Award. And F, other awards, including the Contest Award for officially sanctioned Postal Service contest winners and the Safety Award. 491.2, Management Control. Postal Service managers must use appropriate review and control procedures to identify the superior work of individuals, programs, and operational areas. Managers must ensure that related actions, such as performance evaluations, are fully considered to maintain compatibility between awards and other relevant factors. All levels of management are responsible for ensuring that all employees are treated fairly and equitably and for providing a workplace environment characterized by recognition and celebration of business success. Do you guys feel that you work in that kind of workplace environment, that there is recognition and celebration of success? You know, my station's not too bad. We're treated reasonably well by our supervisors, but we certainly do not have this sort of environment. All right, moving on. Vice presidents, district managers, senior and lead plant managers, and the chief human resources officer periodically audit the awards process. 491.3, awards. 491.31, cash awards. A cash award is issued in the form of a check by accounting services. All cash awards are considered ordinary income and are subject to the following deductions. All your regular deductions are all listed here. Since these payroll deductions are made from cash awards, the net amount of the check will be less than the requested dollar amount. 491. Oh, but the nice thing is, though, at least when you get that check, you know you don't have a bunch of stuff that's going to come out of it on the back end that you have to keep track of. As if when you get that check, I'm sure it's in the mail, as they say. 491.32, cash equivalent awards. A cash equivalent award is a product purchased from an authorized postal service supplier, which is immediately convertible to cash, such as a gift check. All cash equivalent awards, regardless of value, are considered ordinary income and are subject to income tax. All cash equivalent awards must be reported in e-awards under the award category appropriate for the type of employee and the reason for the award. See, there's a whole system in place for this, and it's just not being used. Reporting of cash equivalent should occur in the same pay period in which they are received by the employee, but must occur in the same calendar year to avoid tax reporting discrepancies. Cash equivalent awards are automatically grossed up by e-awards so that the Postal Service assumes the tax liability for the recipient. Oh, that's nice. The additional tax liability is charged to the finance number indicated in e-awards when reported. 491.33, non-cash tangible awards. 491.331, authorized non-cash tangible awards authorized by the Postal Service are described below. See 491.332 for non-cash tangible awards that are prohibited. All right, so here are all the ones that they recognize. A, informal recognition, such as pins, pen and pencil sets, coffee mugs, apparel, plaques, event tickets, etc., valued at less than $100. Dude, how cool would that be that, oh man, you really kicked ass on that handoff last week. You know, thank you for coming in and helping us on your day off. Here's a couple of tickets to a concert, dude. It's fantasy world. One, reporting. Individual non-cash tangible award items valued at less than $100 are not normally considered taxable income and are not reported in e-awards. However, management must track all non-cash tangible items valued at less than $100 received by an employee during the calendar year. If the aggregate total of all non-cash tangible items valued at less than $100 received by an employee in a calendar year meets or exceeds $100, the total amount must be reported in e-awards under the appropriate non-cash tangible award type for the employee category and the reason for the award. You know, this actually got me thinking about last summer, management bought like Gatorades and like electrolyte mixes and stuff like that. And they had us, it was like during safety stand-up talks, and they had like a basketball hoop that had a bunch of water bottles around it. And if you made it in the hoop, then you got a Gatorade. I wonder if that's the kind of thing that they consider one of these non-cash tangible award items. Dude, I mean, I guess it's better than not getting anything, but that's about the closest to any of these type of awards that I can ever remember seeing. Two, event tickets. Tickets to a specific event, game, play, concert, movie, etc. for a definite time and place that cannot be exchanged for another event, time, or place, etc. and are valued at less than $100 are informal awards and do not constitute reportable income. However, if any of the preceding items valued at $100 or more, or any certificate that can be exchanged or redeemed for a ticket or tickets to an event at the time and place of the recipient's choice, regardless of value, are considered gift certificates and must be reported in e-awards under the appropriate non-cash award type. B, formal non-cash tangible recognition, such as clothing, event tickets, merchandise, electronics, and other personal property valued at $100 or more. The market value of formal non-cash tangible award items may range from $100 up to $3,000, depending on the reason for the award. Spot Award, Team Award, Contest Award, etc. All these different awards. Can you believe all these awards we're not getting? Individual non-cash tangible items valued at $100 or more are always considered taxable income and should be reported in e-awards in the same pay period in which they are received under the appropriate non-cash award type for the employee category and reason for the award. Reporting must take place in the same calendar year to avoid tax reporting discrepancies. Non-cash tangible awards are automatically grossed up by e-awards so that the Postal Service assumes the tax liability for the recipient. The additional tax liability for grossed up awards is charged to the finance number indicated when reported in e-awards. 491.332, prohibited. The purchase of any season or partial season sporting or entertainment ticket is prohibited. The purchase of any single event ticket that costs $100 or more requires advance approval in the form of an email or letter from the Vice President Controller. 491.34, gift certificates. Dude, we can get gift certificates. We should get those, right? The value of gift certificate awards may range from $1 to $3,000, depending on the reason for the award and employee category. A, all gift certificates, regardless of dollar value, are considered taxable income by the IRS and should be reported in e-awards in the pay period they are received, blah, blah, blah. B, the e-awards withholds the appropriate payroll deductions from your paycheck to cover the amount that you got. And C, gift certificates valued at $50 or more presented to all employees are grossed up by e-awards so that the Postal Service assumes the tax liability for the recipient. The additional tax liability is charged to the finance number indicated when reported. 492, Certificate of Appreciation. 492.3, Description. So this is now the specific awards and how you're supposed to get them. The Certificate of Appreciation is a non-monetary award consisting of a printed certificate with the Postal Service corporate signature and Certificate of Appreciation printed at the top. At the discretion of the approving official, a commendatory letter may accompany the certificate. The certificate and letter of commendation, if included, are presented in an official service award folder. 492.5, Basis. The Certificate of Appreciation may be issued for noteworthy assistance to the Postal Service. Examples of such contributions are A, reflecting credit on the Postal Service through civic service and humanitarian endeavors. B, participating significantly in Postal Service programs such as saving bond drives, combined federal campaigns, and blood donor drives. C, performing exceptionally in one or more important job projects. D, meeting unusual demands on one's own initiative, along with regularly assigned duties during unplanned absences of associates. E, improving public relations or sustaining good public relations in unusual circumstances. F, enabling a unit to meet unanticipated demands by performance of unusual duties for short periods. G, demonstrating unusual courage or competence in an emergency. H, improving service through actions that Postal Service management feels are significant. You know, at my station, we have a custodian. He's new to our station. Our last custodian actually died, and we thought he was fine. We all liked him, and he was a good enough dude. You know, he did okay. But this new custodian that's come in is like a whirlwind. And he's like waxing the floors and getting work orders and repainting stuff. And the guy is like amazing. And I think I'm going to recommend them to management for one of these awards. Because, man, the station, it's like he went on vacation for a week. And I was also off for a while. And I came in one day and I'm like, oh, my God, Rob must be on vacation. Because the station was like falling apart without him. And he really has just done a phenomenal job since he's been with us. So I'm going to recommend them. 493, Service Awards. 493.21, Description. The Service Award Pin, a non-cash recognition award given at a milestone. A non-cash recognition award given at milestone years consists of an emblem pin and a letter of appreciation issued in recognition of government service. The letter of appreciation is signed by the installation head or functional organization head for an employee with 25, 30, 35, 40, or 45 years of service, signed by the Postmaster General for an employee with 50 years of service, and presented in an official service award folder. 493.22, Basis. The Service Award pin is presented to career employees who have completed all those number of years of service, and all federal, civilian, and military service is considered creditable. 494, Informal Award. 494.2, Purpose. The Informal Award provides a quick and simple method for recognizing employees and contractors who regularly perform duties beyond normal work requirements or who have performed a specific exceptional task or action. 494.3, Description. The Informal Award is a non-cash, tangible item of less than $100 in value obtained or purchased locally, such as a plaque, coffee mug, an article of clothing, tickets to a specific entertainment event, or similar item. 494.5, Basis. The basis for this award is an employee contribution, sustained performance, or achievement. The employee must A, consistently perform regular duties in an exemplary manner, or B, accomplish a specific act beyond the normal duties. 494.6, Approval Authority. The immediate supervisor is the approving official for the informal award. Dude, this is one they could give out like candy. They could give out this award, you know, anybody at your station who's been doing a really good job. Like, there's people at my station for sure, like this dude Santos, who just does a really good job. He's a very good worker. His route is clean. You know, another one is Chris. Chris, you're probably listening to this. Chris does a great job. Like, he's low on the overtime list because he does above and beyond, and he always gets his work done quickly. And so he doesn't get as much overtime as other people. But, dude, that's another guy who his route is, like, completely immaculate. He's super reliable. And to me, somebody like him is exactly the kind of candidate that supervisors should be putting in for this sort of award. 495, Formal Awards. 495.2, Spot Award. 495.21, Purpose. The purpose of a spot award is to provide immediate recognition for a specific action or achievement beyond what is normally expected of an employee. It is not to be used as an incentive for pre-established goals or objectives. A spot award may be used to recognize a wide range of performance or actions. 495.22, Description. A spot award is one of the following. A, a check issued by accounting services. B, a cash equivalent product that can be immediately converted to cash. C, a merchandise item of at least $100 in value. D, a gift certificate. 495.24, Basis. The basis for presenting a spot award is an employee contribution, sustained performance, achievement, invention, special act, or service that exceeds usual work requirements. The employee must A, exceed requirements in one or more important job elements for 12 months or more. B, devise new or improved methods that save manpower, space, materials, equipment, or other cost items. C, contribute to outstanding economy, efficiency, added income, or measurably improve service to the public. D, break production records or inspire others to improve quantity and quality of work. E, risk life or personal safety in an act of heroism. You know, it's possible that the people we see in the postal record who save somebody's life, they found the old lady on the floor in her house and called the paramedics, or, you know, rescued a bunch of orphans from a building, burning building, maybe they get these spot awards. I hope they do. F, maintain work schedule in absence of supervisor or meet unusual demands of higher level duties on one's own initiative. 495.3, Non-Career Gift Certificate. Purpose. A 495.31, Purpose. The purpose of the Non-Career Gift Certificate Award is to provide immediate recognition for a specific action or achievement beyond the normal work requirements of a non-career employee, also known as the CCA. It is not to be used as an incentive for achievement of pre-established goals or objective. The Non-Career Gift Certificate Award may be used to recognize a wide range of performance or actions. So you have a CCA who's been especially helpful, works all the time, doesn't complain, does a really good job. Boom, there's your non-career gift certificate. 495.32, Description. A non-career gift certificate award consists of a gift certificate not greater than $100 in value purchased locally in accordance with Postal Service and local purchasing rules and regulations. Eligible employees may receive up to $500 in gift certificate awards in a fiscal year. Dude, they could be giving these out to these CCAs who just bust their ass. You know the way CCAs get crapped on. They get the short end of the stick all the time. And this would be a way to thank them. It's right there. And, dude, 495.34 basis. The basis for presenting a non-career gift certificate award is an employee contribution that exceeds usual work requirements. Now the big one, 495.4, quality step increase award. 495.41, description. The quality step increase, QSI, is an increase in basic pay that recognizes sustained high-quality performance. The total dollar benefit usually exceeds that of a one-time cash award and is granted only when the level of performance is likely to continue. You know, again, somebody like Santos at my station, I think, would be a great candidate for this. I know you guys don't know Santos, except for the few at my station who listen to this podcast. And I'm sure there are other people at my station as well. He's just somebody who I've dealt with who immediately comes to mind. 495.42, eligibility. All career bargaining unit employees not already at the top step for their pay grade. Oh, see, that's probably why I haven't gotten one, because I'm already at the top step. Otherwise, dude, for sure, they'd give me one of these. Anybody who's not already at their top step are eligible to receive the QSI. An employee cannot receive more than one QSI in any 52-week period. Now, see, the way this is written, they're planning on giving these out so often that they have to put limitations. Like, hey, man, you can only get one of these a year. Dude, you get one in your freaking lifetime. 495.43, basis. High-quality performance can be determined only after a thorough review of position requirements, duties, and responsibilities. Consideration must be given to the quality and quantity of work, demonstrated professional and technical knowledge, manual skills, and other evidence of superior competence. Performance criteria include one or more of the following. A. The most important of the job. The most important function of the job is being performed in a manner that substantially exceeds normal requirements. B. Another function of the job is being performed in a manner that is better than satisfactory. C. A specific job was sustained at a high level during the preceding year and gives promise of continuing. 495.441, comparison, regular within grade increases. A QSI requires exceptional authorization by management and is always in addition to regular pay adjustments required by the labor contracts. Any employee below the highest step is eligible to receive a QSI. And then there's a few other awards that are listed in here that usually involve system-wide contributions. So, you know, you developed a new piece of equipment or something like that. And then finally, we get to the last one, 497.3, the Safety Award. 497.31, purpose. The Safety Award is intended to provide a motivational tool for improving and encouraging safe working conditions and work habits in the Postal Service. It can be used as a motivational tool or as a reward for a specific action that prevented an unsafe act from occurring. Dude, they should give me one of these for getting an ice machine at my station. But really, they'd have to give it to all of us because the whole station pulled together to get that ice machine. I was just the one who was ornery about it. 497.32, description. The safety award consists of non-cash tangible merchandise and items and gift certificates, or non-cash tangible merchandise items and gift certificates valued between $1 and $500. Items are to be produced locally or procured locally. Dude, good thing I'm almost done with this. Items are to be procured locally via normal non-cash tangible item or gift certificate purchasing procedures. Cash and cash equivalents are not to be used as safety awards. And oh, dude, cross the finish line just in time. All right, so hopefully you guys learned something from this. That is the end of the 400s. When we come back on a future episode, I think I'm going to do something in between to break it up. We will get into the 500s. I still have another like 15 pages of notes on the ELM, so well ahead of schedule on that. And in the meantime, dude, take some of this stuff back to your station. You know, ask the folks at your station, where's these awards? How come we're not getting this stuff? It doesn't always have to be a stick. You can use a carrot. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. I will catch you next time.